It's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 77 for Friday the 25th of May. On the show today, after a false start involving a faulty nitrogen valve, the first commercial rocket has blasted into Earth's orbit and is preparing to dock with the International Space Station. The mayor of Naples has granted permission for geologists to drill into a supervolcano. Let's hope that doesn't go badly. And can you patent a cut of beef? Oklahoma State University claims to have discovered a new steak and is giving it a go. All that and more coming up in mere moments. Hello, I'm Duncan Gear, and I'm the news editor of Wired.co.uk. And joining me in what we call a studio this week is associate editor Olivia underscore Solon. Hello, Liv.
Hello.
How are you?
Good. This is different.
It is different, isn't it? We've got no Nate today.
Yeah, you're doing a great job.
Thank you so much. Nate is in the United States of America finding out what Microsoft Research has been up to lately. And we're going to have a little report from him in a little while. But first, before that, history has been made. Commercial space history has been made.
It has. SpaceX has become the first commercial company to launch a craft towards the ISS. It hasn't quite yet docked with the ISS, but perhaps by the time you listen to this, it will have done. Now, the unmanned Falcon 9 rocket launched this week and placed the Dragon space capsule into orbit. And it's currently in orbit, and it's going to hopefully reach the ISS pretty soon. It's the first attempt by a commercial company to actually service the ISS, and so it will have lots of supplies, and it will also be picking up any junk and stuff they want to get rid of from the ISS and taking it back to Earth.
But there's no humans on board.
There are no humans on board. No, it's an unmanned rocket. But they had a bit of a problem when they first wanted to launch last week. The rocket had to be aborted just half a second before it launched because there was...
Half a second?
Yeah.
Wow.
Everyone was watching the live countdown and suddenly they had to abort it. And they detected high pressure readings in the engine. So it was probably a good idea that they cancelled it. But after investigations, it turned out they had a faulty valve. So they replaced that and have now successfully launched.
And what does, I guess we don't really necessarily know this yet, but what does this mean for the future of space exploration?
Good question. I guess it means that we're going to be seeing more and more, commercial space flights in the future. It's something that we've been talking about a lot on this podcast, but this is the first example of it actually kind of really working, I guess, in terms of this hybrid between publicly funded and privately funded space exploration.
Sounds amazing. Okay, well, let's move over to Italy, where the mayor of Naples, Luigi de Magistris, possibly?
Yeah,
I'm not very good with my Italian pronunciation, has approved the very first stages of a plan to drill into a caldera on the outskirts of Naples.
So what's a caldera?
Okay, so a caldera is formed, it's kind of the central bit of the volcano. It's formed when, this particular one was formed over thousands of years after the collapse of several volcanoes in the area. It's 13 kilometres wide, lying mostly underwater, and it contains a bunch of different craters and other volcanic edifices spewing out toxic gases into the sky. The Romans, actually, centuries ago, thought that it was the home of Vulcan, the god of fire.
So the headline on this story called it a supervolcano. Does that just mean a collection of little volcanoes under a big old volcano?
It's basically a massive, great big area of magma under the earth that's under huge amounts of pressure. And so you might think that drilling into it is possibly a bad idea.
Yeah, so what is the point of drilling into this supervolcano?
Basically to try and find out about the risks that it poses. In 2008, there was a team of experts that wanted to drill 4 kilometres down into the caldera, but they were vetoed by the mayor at the time because a geologist kind of proposed, said that there were going to be big risks of this project. They were worried that there were going to be potentially seismic activity and even explosions as a result.
Okay, so this sounds to me like going up to a lion and poking it with a stick to see what happens.
To see how dangerous it is.
Yeah, I mean, they're saying, oh, we just want to see how much of a risk it is. Could this not provoke some horrendous apocalyptic ending to our world?
Well, if it did erupt, then basically you'd end up with lots and lots of tiny little particles that go into the atmosphere. And what those do is they block out the incoming solar radiation, and so it makes it much more difficult for plants to grow and stuff like that. It would mean the global temperature cools, but only temporarily.
Okay.
So and we've seen that kind of in the historical record in the past. But what Naples' new mayor has done, De Magistris, He's given the green light to drilling a pilot hole 500 metres deep, not the full 4 kilometres that they want. And they're going to fill it with sensors to monitor how the surface above the caldera rises and falls due to movements of the magma within.
What's the worst case scenario?
The end of the human race. But that's not enormously likely.
But is this something that geologists have been really keen to try out for a while?
Very much so. I mean, they want to find out much more about this area and about how it operates on what are the kind of geological processes that are going on inside this thing. And the only way really to do that is to get down there and find out.
So when's this all going to start then?
Well, drilling should start within a few months' time, and then beyond that, they just need to start filling it up with sensors. And then if it goes well, other sort of scientists have pointed out that other multi-kilometre holes drilled in similar areas around the world, none of those have resulted in explosions. So we should be okay. And assuming it does all go well, then we should be able to start getting some data back within the next couple of years.
So beyond just finding out what happens when you drill a hole into a supervolcano,
when you poke it with a stick,
what can you discover from this, or is there any kind of useful application of the heat or anything like that?
Well, of course, there's the geothermal benefits. Like, you know, if they can pump water down there and bring it back up as steam, then they can generate electricity. Mm. And they're hoping that might be a possibility. That's another motivation for doing this, to try and find out if they can use the energy that's stored under the crust there to generate power.
Awesome.
Very awesome. Well, the next story we are going to move on to is one of yours, Liv. This is an interesting one about Oklahoma State University claiming to have discovered a new steak and trying to patent it. Is that right?
Yeah, they've called it the Vegas Strip Steak, the sexiest of steaks. And they said they found it somewhere on the carcass of a cow. And it was in an area that was usually considered low value and was minced up for use in things like hamburgers. However, they say they developed a specific technique that when it's cut correctly, produces a steak that's on par or better than other very popular steaks. And one of the key things is it doesn't need aging. And because they say they've discovered this, they're trying to patent it, which is a very odd kind of concept.
Why is that so odd?
Because you're trying to patent something that you haven't really invented. I guess they have to talk about the technique and the technology more, but it's kind of like a cutting technique. So theoretically, by cutting their steak into another shape, I could be inventing a new steak, which is a kind of odd situation. And quite often, you know, it's very hard to patent recipes. Normally, companies like Coca-Cola and KFC have trade secrets, which are very closely guarded recipes, but they've gone for a different route here.
So why can't they do the trade secret thing with this?
They could potentially, but it'd be much more difficult because the way that steak, well, beef is sold and processed means that it takes place at lots of different plants throughout the country or throughout the world. And so you'd have to train up all the people who process that meat to be able to use this technique. So you'd have a lot of people who knew this trade secret. So it's very hard to control it that way. So what they want to do is patent their steak and then license the right to produce and then sell that steak to the different meat processing plants.
So they're not actually patenting the steak itself, they're patenting the knife movements used to chop it out of the cow.
Well, they are patenting the steak, but they are packaging the steak up as, you know, involving the process of creating the steak as well as, you know, the resulting Vegas Strip.
Okay. And is there kind of like, there's obviously sort of GM grain and stuff has been patented in the past. Has there been any similar other kind of like meat things that have been patented?
Well, there's that mega food manufacturer Monsanto in the US. Yes, they've patented grain, but they've also been trying to patent pig breeds, but I think so far unsuccessfully. But I'm not aware of any other cases of cut of meat being patented.
As in kind of like, by breeds you mean they've bred a pig specifically and its genes are so distinctly different from other pigs that they,
exactly,
they're calling it a new creation.
Exactly, yes.
Wow, okay, that's an interesting one. And so what do you think the outcome of this is likely to be?
I think unless they can show that their technique is extremely radically different, I think it's going to be hard, they're going to be hard pushed to get this one through. Just because, unless it requires some very specific piece of machinery, which it doesn't sound like it does, it sounds like it's just certain knife technique. It's kind of akin to saying, I'm going to patent the salad that I made for lunch, or you know, the way that I've spread the butter on my toast, I'm going to patent it. It just doesn't really make sense for me.
Okay. Well, we'll keep an eye on that one as time goes by. But the next story we're going to move on to is one about insect communities under streetlights. The University of Exeter has found that street lighting has actually changed the composition of communities of insects in the UK.
So how's it changed them?
Well, they found that although bugs are... Well, I mean, it's obvious that bugs are attracted to these lights. We see that whenever it's dark and there's a load of bugs around. But they found that total numbers of insects were obviously more abundant under the lamps, but that the balance of insects has changed, okay? There are different types of insect that you get. There are predatory ones, there are scavengers, there are grazers, parasites, and detritivores, which basically just eat the junk of everything else.
That's a great word.
And the balance in under the street lights changed firmly in favour of the predatory and the scavenging species over the others. And the worry is that these altered communities could have an effect on the ecosystems that eat them as well. So the birds that eat them and the mammals that eat these insects could be changed similarly.
So hang on, is this just around lights where the populations of these insects are changed? Or are they thinking that this is representative of the wider populations altogether?
Well, what they did is they put pitfall traps directly below street lamps and between them as well for a bunch of days and nights. And they collected nearly 1,200 different insects from 60 different species, and they looked at those to find out. So they compared the populations next to the street lamps with the ones that aren't next to the street lamps.
Okay.
So they're basically trying to work out the difference between the populations of both of them.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And as I say, the fear is that when there's more predatory and scavenging species, then the mammals and birds that eat those predatory and scavenging species will do considerably better than the species that eat the ones that are being crowded out by comparison. And so that could change, that could have big knock-on effects down in the ecosystems.
So is the issue here that we need to perhaps think about reducing street lighting in order to protect these ecosystems?
Well, Tom Davies of the Environment and Sustainability Institute at the University of Exeter, who carried out this research, says we need to be aware of how the increase in artificial lighting is impacting on the delicate ecosystems which we all rely. He's not saying tear down all the streetlights, which is probably for the best, because that's almost certainly not going to happen. But it's more about being aware of how this is going to affect our food networks and, you know, our environments, and how and what we can do to mitigate some of that damage.
Do we have any idea how the tip and balance in favour of these kind of meaner insects, what eats those meaner insects versus the ones that the more kind of herb, what are they called? The grazers
and the detritivores.
And the detritivores.
We know a bit about kind of what eats these creatures. You know, there's a certain amount of biological research or zoological research that's gone into this and about what eats what. And so we can start to construct a bit of a web of how it all works, but an awful lot more research is obviously going to be needed on these specific kinds of insects and a lot of attention on these insects to try and work out more definitively what the effects are going to be. Okay, well, let's move on to an ad break now. And when we come back, we'll find out what you can do with that little bit of Yeti that you've been storing in your loft.
Wired magazine, published digitally every month on iPad. Now available to our print subscribers at no extra cost. For more information or to subscribe to the paper and iPad editions for just £2 per issue, go to wired.co.uk/iPad.
Welcome back. Next, we are going to talk a little bit about the Open Data Institute, which was launched by Tim Berners-Lee and Nigel Shadbolt this week. And Liv, you've been following this quite closely, haven't you?
Yeah, this was something that was announced last November by George Osborne, and the idea was to create a centre of excellence for open data. Now, there's been an increasing kind of push for governments and companies to release some of the data, specifically the data that has been funded by public money. And already we've seen stuff like data about transport, you know, where the buses are at what time, and some environmental data that the government collects being released. But this centre of excellence has been set up to try and find ways to kind of commercialise that data. So the idea is to focus on kind of incubating and nurturing new businesses that want to use open data, and then kind of train people up in how to use open data and promote kind of national standards.
So let's rewind a little bit here for the listeners who are a little bit confused by all this. What is open data?
So Open data is data that is placed somewhere. I think the government data is all placed on data.gov.uk, and it's made available for any developers or any researchers to access and then build applications or any kind of tools they want to on top of that.
So a bit like the TfL Journey Planner, for example.
Exactly. The TfL Journey Planner data was released, and it allows people to build iPhone apps and Android apps that kind of they can then sell and cross-reference with other data they might be collecting.
Okay, and what kind of businesses are they looking to attract in this? Is it all about startups, or is it about larger businesses that
it's
can
both.
Use this data?
Their remit does sound, they don't think they've kind of fully defined their remit. It seems to be fairly broad. They're looking for startups, particularly people at university who've got an idea, so they really want to get entrenched within the universities, which I think is a great thing, and bring ideas through to becoming businesses. But they also want large companies to A, help fund the initiative, but B, help them to learn how they could best use open data and even use it, you know, when you cross-reference it with your own data, how you can then build business models on top of that.
And they've been targeting students as well, haven't they?
Exactly. They're looking specifically for university students who might not even have a business, but they might just have an idea for a startup. So they want those people to come in and they'll help them set up a business.
Okay. And the objective here isn't, of course, to just, you know, make everything open and free and all that kind of stuff. It's to make money, right?
They recognise that there's some important role that open data can play in terms of transparency and government accountability, but they also feel that there's an immense economic benefit. And the focus on this institute is about that economic benefit. And quite often it's hard to predict. I think Tim Berners-Lee, who I spoke to, said that there's this serendipity effect. You quite often don't know how that data is going to be used. So they can encourage the government to release it, but then it takes a developer who happens to cross-reference it with another feed that someone else is generating elsewhere to make something really kind of magical happen.
Okay. And another thing that I think people might be wondering is whether there's any kind of like privacy implications here. Like, is there any personalised data available to these people?
Well, all of the data released in the open is anonymised, but there is always a risk of what's known as the mosaic effect. And this is where, you know, seemingly innocuous bits of information are combined with other available information to kind of form a more meaningful whole. And that can identify people sometimes. And so part of the remit of the Institute is actually to research this. And they are considering doing something like getting the government licence to stipulate that it's kind of illegal to de-anonymize data. So you're allowed to use this data, but provided you don't try and triangulate it with other data feeds to identify people for nefarious purposes.
Okay, I see. And obviously the government announced it last November and it's been detailed now. When does it actually open?
It opens in September. They've got an open invitation now for people to kind of come and suggest how they want to use this institute, but officially it will open in September.
Lovely.
So, Duncan, before the ad break, you mentioned that if people had bits of Yeti in their freezer, perhaps...
I think loft, I suppose. Got a freezer in their loft,
okay.
I suppose.
Well, if you've got bits of Yeti in your loft, why would you not keep it in the freezer, first of all? But secondly, Oxford University might be able to use it.
Yeah, they're looking for people who've got, or institutions that have got, collections of all kinds of cryptozoological material to submit it for analysis to find out what actually it is.
And so is this about kind of debunking myths? The people who are kind of have been insisting that they've got that Yeti scalp for decades, now they have an opportunity to kind of prove either way whether it's real.
Whether it is a creature unknown to science. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's certainly an aspect of that. I mean, the motivation is very much that to try and find out a bit more about what these specimens are to, yes, debunk some myths, but it's also possible that this genetic information could tell us more about how different species, if it's not a Yeti, which it probably isn't, how different species are spreading around the world.
Okay, and so is this because the technology has presumably made some advancements, you know, in the last 10 years that would help scientists analyse these pieces?
Well, yeah, genetic analysis is easier than ever, essentially. It's become, you know, reasonably cheap. It's still kind of expensive, but reasonably cheap to scan the DNA and work out how match it up with other life forms. And what Oxford is doing is they're trying to build up essentially a database of samples of organic remains around the world that are supposedly cryptozoological. And they're asking anyone who's got one to submit the details of where and when it was collected and a few other bits bits and bobs, like what it is and stuff. And they're going to pick the most interesting ones. Apparently, they're particularly interested in hair shafts. And ask the owners if they will, if they're willing to submit them for actual proper genetic analysis.
Okay, so I find a bit of old hair in my loft. What else could I potentially submit for analysis?
Well, anything that contains genetic material, really. I mean, and it will depend on how old it is and various other factors as to how much useful stuff there'll be in it. But the results of the analysis will be published in peer-reviewed journals. So, as you say, the objective is very much to debunk some of these claims that certain organisations have, and for people to say, well, if that actually is a Yeti, then why don't you submit it? They haven't submitted it.
Do you have any idea how many people think that they have got bits of Yeti in their loft?
A surprising amount, actually. Well, maybe not in their loft, but there are a surprising amount of places around the world that have, you know, bits of... It's kind of interesting because almost every culture around the world that's close to kind of remote areas has some kind of myth of similar cryptozoological creatures, because you've got Sasquatch in North America and Bigfoot, and you've got the Yeti and the Metair, I think it's called, in Tibet, and there's various other ones all around the world. And I should probably point out that it isn't just Yetis and Bigfoots and things that they're after.
Unicorns.
They're after any kind of cryptozoological animal. So what are those rabbit things with antlers called? I can't remember what they're
Chupacabra?
Called.
Chupacabra? But that's not the rabbit thing with antlers.
That's a different thing.
That's the goat sucker.
That's the goat sucker. Well, anyway, they're after all kinds of cryptozoological animals and bits of to try and work out what they actually are.
Haggis. Unicorns.
Haggis, definitely haggis.
Dragons, all of the above.
Send them some haggis.
What constitutes a cryptozoological? Is it one that people don't know whether it exists or it's...
Well, I think it's that there's no evidence for it actually existing. There's just like legends and myths around it.
So it could be totally made up.
It could entirely be totally made up. But so, usually there's some form of truth behind the legend somewhere. It's possible, like some people think that the Yetis might be actually, or the legends of Yetis might be remains of Neanderthals that existed up in the Himalayas.
Okay.
But that seems relatively unlikely.
Excellent.
Well, speaking of strange creatures from around the world, let's move over to Nate Langson. So that was a bit mean, wasn't it?
He's a curious creature.
A curious creature. Well, he's been over in Microsoft Research in the States, and he has sent us this report of what he's been up to.
Hey guys, Nate here, checking in from Seattle at the moment. I've been spending the last couple of days wandering around some of the murkier, darker corners of Microsoft's campus up in Redmond, which is nearby, looking at some of the research projects going on in Microsoft Research and some of its laboratories, hardware labs, software labs, things like that. There's been a few things that have been quite interesting that I hadn't seen before. One of them isn't something that's being researched anymore, but I hadn't seen it in the past, so I thought it was worth mentioning. And what it actually is if you can imagine a contact lens with a circuit board on it and sort of moisture detectors, things like that, built into it. This was a prototype that was created to test blood sugar levels for diabetics, but rather than so the traditional way of pricking the skin and taking a blood sample, this was able to read the blood sugar levels, believe it or not, from tears, specifically tears. And unfortunately, the project wasn't continued because turns out there's quite a problem getting power to a contact lens pressed against somebody's eyeball, and a problem with heat meant that it could be quite uncomfortable. But it was a very interesting project to see, at least having existed in the past. And I got to see the actual contact lens in question, which really did look like a sort of a perfectly normal contact lens, but with a very visible circuit board on the inside. Took a couple of photos, and I'm going to put those on the site, hopefully by the time you hear this. One of the other projects I've seen, well, in fact, there were two other ones I wanted to mention, and these were from the Connect Accelerator Program, and there were two startups, one based in Munich and one based in France, that had come up with interesting new ways of using the Kinect sensor, which before now has been used mostly with the Xbox 360, but more recently has been used with Windows PCs for sort of less gaming purposes and more developmental stuff. The first one from Munich was a company called Ubi, and they had made this system where the Kinect sensor was hooked up to a projector, and the projector, which was itself connected to a PC, would project any PC image from a PC onto a wall. So it could be a Windows desktop, or we were shown Angry Birds, we were shown a PowerPoint. And what it actually did was, by using the depth sensor in the Kinect, it could detect where a person's hand was, it could detect where a person was tapping and pointing or using multi-touch gestures with two hands to sort of zoom in or zoom out of an image. And it was basically making a touchscreen out of any surface. So if you can imagine a typical boardroom projector projecting a 60-inch image onto a wall, by connecting this with the Kinect hardware and a bit of software, you would basically be able to walk up to that projected image and tap on links in a web page, or if it was something like Google Earth, be able to sort of, you know, zoom in on the Earth by spreading your hands, open or closed over the image. Really, really interesting. They're going to start selling this product, or I think possibly have started selling it already. Very, very interesting bunch of guys. And I'm going to do something on the site about them. And the other company I saw, another startup, a French company, and they've got a product called Skenect. That's S-K-N-E-C-T. And what this did was basically create a fully interactive 3D image of, well, pretty much anything. They'd done it with a kind of, looked like a papier-mâché foot. But you could actually create 3D images of any room that you were in. And in the demo that I saw, I was sort of sat in a boardroom, and they took the Kinect out with the software, and sort of standing up straight, just sort of rotated themselves 360 degrees, keeping the Kinect itself fairly steady. And it created a perfect, as close to perfect as you can get with a system like this, but certainly a very respectable 3D photograph of the entire room. And it's not like a 3D movie or a 3D image that you'd have in a 3D film, where you'd wear glasses and it would just look like things were coming out of the screen at you. This was an image a bit more like a CAD drawing, where you can, you know, blow up the image, bring it closer to you, spin it round in all directions, zoom in, zoom out, things like that. But it was a 3D version of this room, and so I got to see myself on screen within a few seconds. It looked like a very rough, full-color 3D photograph that you could zoom in on me, you could zoom around me, you could rotate the room, zoom in and out of the room. It was pretty amazing, and, you know, it could have real interesting potential with things like, real estate agents being able to walk into a house or a building, take a fully 3D photograph of every room, and then allow people on a web interface to virtually walk through this 3D representation of a house. Really, really interesting concept, and it was one of these things that was so cool I had to get them to give me the demo again, this startup, just so I could video it. So there's going to be a video on the website, and I'm going to do a little write-up on both of these companies. Some really interesting stuff. I also found out, actually, by the way, that Steve Ballmer, CEO of Microsoft, of course, has a 80-inch Windows 8 tablet hanging up in his office, which has replaced his phone and has replaced his paper and things like that. So I've already written a story that's live on the site now. Anyway, I'll be back next week and have a bunch of things on the site, hopefully by Friday or certainly Saturday, including some videos of the couple of the Kinect projects that we saw today and that I just mentioned. So all good. Back over to you guys in the Trinket Cupboard.
Lovely stuff. Thank you so much, Nate. It is wonderful to hear your voice. I know the listeners were missing you. Well, that's pretty much all we've had time for on the show this week. Liv, how about you tell us how people can get in touch with the show if they want to send us their Yeti bits?
Yeti bits? I'm now thinking of rude things, of bits of Yeti. anyway, there's many ways you can get in touch. The first way is by calling us on 0208 123 0468. And you can call us from a landline or a mobile, and it'll be charged at the UK local rate. Or you can call us on Skype for free. We're Wired UK Podcast altogether, and you can leave a message, and we're looking for up to 30 seconds, which we will replay in the podcast. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're at Wired UK. Facebook, we have a fantastic page, facebook.com/WiredUK. And finally, you can email us podcast@wired.co.uk.
And you very much should. I will say that if you have sent us a voicemail over the last week, we can't actually get to it at the moment because Nate's the only person who's got the password. I think we got an email saying we got a notification that we had some voicemails.
I feel bad because last week I told people to don't come rant on us. So I suspect that maybe people have reacted angrily and decided to rant extensively in protest.
Well, maybe we will find out next week.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for listening, and tell all your friends about the wired.co.uk podcast if you like us, and we will see you next week.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
is a caldera, actually.
It is a volcano. It's like the crater of a volcano.
Okay.